Hello, this is Janice Schweizer with the Pantograph dated Tuesday, January 7th, 2020, and we will begin today's reading with the front page article entitled Stamps of Approval. There's Just Something About Having a Small Town Post Office by Kennedy Nolan. Zip code 62532 appears in blue numerals on the front of the Elwyn Post Office, a shack-like structure on South Taylor Road with 52 neat post office boxes behind a worn front door. Even though the tiny space, the public area, is maybe the size of a freight elevator, is open from 7:15 to 11 a.m. weekdays, it is an important linchpin in this unincorporated Macon County area south of Decatur. I think they really, really appreciate it, said 40-year resident Kathy Isom. There's just something about having a small-town post office. For far-flung communities in rural areas, these humble government buildings remain an essential communal link in an otherwise distant world of email and social media, a quaint part of the American landscape facing rapid changes from technology and e-commerce. Here, between picking up stamps and retrieving letters, neighbors interact, swap gossip, and share needs. More than that, a post office symbolizes a status, literally marking a place as a community, even if the modest buildings are only a few hundred square feet. Sometimes you see different neighbors and meet people here, said Jerry Blackwell, as he stood at the Booty Post Office off State Route 148. He visits the A-frame brick building every afternoon, often bringing his four-year-old Corgi Beagle mix, Cody. They both like socializing. The clerk has dog treats. I just whisper the words post office and he's up and at 'em, Blackwell said, as the dogs scampered around the lobby. The power of the post office translates to Blackwell, too. He's lived here for 14 years, and even though Booty has only about 300 residents, Blackwell still somehow finds strangers. Sometimes you see different neighbors and meet people here, he said. A lot of people I still don't know in Booty. No matter if it's a small town or not, you don't know everybody. I don't. Outposts, like the Elwyn and Booty offices, are the backbone of the U.S. Postal Service, which has a daunting 204,274 delivery vehicles and 633,000 employees, according to the latest annual report submitted to Congress last month. Overall, the Postal Service has about 31,000 post offices handling 471 million pieces of mail, but has faced decades of budget issues as more billing and correspondence goes digital. A decade ago, and with the post office facing a $7 billion deficit, a plan to shutter 1,000 post offices and 153 mail processing centers unleashed a strong opposition from rural areas, as well as officials worried about the impact on mail-in ballots. Ending Saturday delivery was on the table at one point. Eventually, the plan was scaled back and reduced hours were put into place. In Lawndale, with a population of about 150 in Logan County, the community has one residential address and 40 post office box addresses. Operations are housed in a modular building. Here, hours of operation are crunched even tighter, being open only for the early birds between 6:15 and 8:15 a.m. Bigger post offices also oversee smaller offices. For example, Sullivan supervises Windsor's office, and Decatur oversees Elwyn, Booty, and Harristown. Kimberly Caldwell Harvey, a spokeswoman for the Postal Service District that includes Central Illinois, said they changed hours to match demand and based on meetings and surveys. There are several retail locations within a 5 to 10 mile radius of one another that have staggered times of operations to accommodate neighboring communities, providing them retail services, she said. In Logan County, the 200 or so residents of Beeson, about 30 miles southwest of Decatur, have a 4-hour window to purchase stamps or ship a package during weekdays and 2 hours on Saturdays. The red brick structure on Broadway is overseen by Lincoln, and there is one mail route, leaving many to collect their mail at the main office. Jody Duncan retired as postmaster in 2015 after working for the U.S. Postal Service for over two decades. "It was the place where people would come in and gather and talk," Duncan said. "Communication is not as big an issue as it was before. They needed letters to get in contact with people across town or across states." Duncan remembers when other offices in rural farm towns were getting hours condensed. She reasoned that reduced hours were better than closing completely. In her case, she was left with two options, retire or leave Beeson. Luckily, Duncan had enough time with the USPS to retire. "When post offices get downsized, it takes something away from the community," she said. Said Duncan, "In most smaller towns, the customers are usually older people who use that stamp, still mail out Christmas cards." Deb Harrison grew up in Beeson and moved to Bloomington after graduating from Illinois State University in the late 1970s. She comes back often to visit her parents or pick up mail and calls the post office the focal point of the town. "I think it's sad that the town is dwindling," she said, thinking about the town's grocery store, restaurant, and a couple of gas stations. At least they have their post office to depend on. Financial issues remain a reality for the Postal Service. In fiscal year 2019, the Postal Service recorded a net loss of $8.8 billion, according to the annual report submitted to Congress. The agency continues to have staggering pension debts and is adjusting after Amazon, which for years represented a sizable part of its business, began delivering products itself. Revenues continued to be pressured by the ongoing erosion of mail volumes. Because mail services account for nearly 63% of our revenues, this ongoing decline puts significant financial strain on the organization, the annual report said. Caldwell Harvey, the Postal Service spokeswoman, said closures are extremely rare and none locally have shut down in the past 20 years. The Postal Service has kept the nation's smallest post offices open for business while providing a framework to achieve significant cost savings as part of our plan to retain the organization's financial stability, Caldwell Harvey said. There is also a practical reason. Mail delivery isn't offered in some areas, which means people have to come to a central place. In Harristown, a community of about 1,300, for example, mail is delivered south of Route 36, but not north. Still, even though longtime resident Audrey Lyons has home delivery, once a week she still pops into the single-story postal building on Meridian Street, where a bulletin board with news and upcoming community events hangs. "You do meet your neighbors in here, so you visit with them for a little bit," Lyons said. Although Lyons has lived in Harristown for over 40 years, she says the post office is a place where you get to know people that you haven't run into before. "There are other benefits to more modest buildings," Isom said. When she moved to Elwyn, the post office was in the dining room of a home, she said. Today, the building is bigger, but not too big, and big enough to have long wait times, like in larger post offices, she said. "There's people that live outside this area," she said, "that come in here because they don't have to wait in line." Duncan, the retired postmaster, said the personal touch is a big part of why post offices are so important to communities. She recalled how the school bus would drop kids off and they would run inside for candy. "It would brighten her day," she said, "and the building was more than a post office." "We go beyond and above what our duties are," she said, "especially if we're part of the community." Next, NORD questions organization memberships. "Councilman favors government business independence," by Kevin Barlow. A normal councilman wonders if memberships to local business organizations, such as the Normal Uptown Business Association and the McLean County Chamber of Commerce, could be considered conflicts of interest. "I am pro-business. I mean super pro-business," said Councilman Stan Nord. "But I think business and government should not be doing business together. Government should be independent of business." Nord raised his concerns Monday night during the Normal City Council meeting. Nord said in fiscal year 2018, the town gave the Chamber of Commerce $43,344, which included fees for a membership and other donations for business development. The NUBA received $10,000 plus assorted in-kind donations this year, he said. The membership fees are not that much, but I would just rather these organizations come to us and request money when they need it, and we can vote yes or no on it, he said. I would rather do that than get something in return, such as membership. Nord said he has concerns because the chamber, for instance, endorses candidates through its political action committee. The chamber does have a political action committee, but it is a separate entity from the chamber itself, said city manager Pam Reese. We have found value in the chamber membership, and we are a significant employer, and we learn from the chamber. I guess if the council wanted to, we could always terminate our membership. Nord did not propose cutting funding for the organizations, but would rather not be tied to a membership. Councilman Kevin McCarthy, who ran the meeting in place of Mayor Chris Koos, who was not in attendance, said the City of Bloomington is a member of the Chamber and also a downtown business association similar to Normal's Uptown Association. Clearly, the City of Bloomington recognizes that promoting their downtown business district generates a lot of revenue and traffic, visitors, hotel stays, etc., he said. In other business, the council approved the third phase of the J&M planned unit development located south and east of 1000 South Cottage in Normal. The project has been under development since 2017 and will include 74 dwelling units on a 9-acre lot. Prior to the meeting, the Normal Liquor Commission approved a Class R liquor license to AMC Classic Normal 14 Monday night, pending approved inspection reports from the McLean County Health Department, the Normal Fire Inspection Division, and the Normal Building Inspection Department. The council would also have to approve the license. Next, we have Illinois AG. 40 years too long to refund money to customers. Raul suggests payout period of 5 years, by Peter Hancock with Capital News Illinois. Two of the state's largest electric utilities owe their customers a combined $543 million in refunds, according to state regulators, but there is sharp disagreement over how much time the companies should have to pay it back. At issue for Ameren Illinois and Commonwealth Edison, also known as ComEd, is money they collected to pay future tax bills before federal tax cuts took effect in 2018, which lowered those anticipated rates. When the corporate tax rate was slashed from 35% to 21%, both companies found themselves holding on to large surpluses, known as, quote, excess deferred income taxes, close quote, or EDIT. For ComEd, which serves 4 million customers in Chicago and northern Illinois, the excess amounted to $385 million. For Ameren, which serves about 1.2 million customers in central Illinois and the metro east area, it amounted to $158 million. In a pair of rulings last year, the Illinois Commerce Commission, which regulates public utilities, said ComEd could pay off its EDIT over 38 years and Ameren could pay its bill off over 35 years. But on Monday, Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul announced he is asking the ICC to reconsider that decision and shorten the payout period to just 5 years. Consumers paid public utilities rates to ComEd and Ameren, reflecting the higher federal tax rate. And now that the federal tax rate has lowered, fairness dictates that consumers should get that money back, said Raoul in a news release. Allowing an unreasonable refund period of close to 40 years nearly guarantees that many customers will never get their fair share of the refunds. The issue has to do with how utility rates are set and regulated. Essentially, companies are allowed to recover their cost of providing service and make a reasonable rate of return or profit. The cost of service includes such things as the cost of building and operating power plants and transmission lines. It also includes the cost of taxes owed to various levels of government. When a company builds a plant, it recovers that cost over the expected useful life of the plant, typically around 40 years. In their cases before the ICC, ComEd and Ameren acknowledged that the tax law changed reduces their cost of service, but they argued that the duty to return the excess deferred tax money they collected should be spread out over the life of their facilities so that both current and future tax ratepayers will be treated evenly. But it also means customers will see a reduction in their bills, if only a few pennies per month instead of a few dollars, according to Jim Chilson, a spokesman for the Citizens Utility Board, a nonprofit entity established by the state to represent residential and small business customers in utility rate cases. In testimony before the ICC, both Raul's office and CUB argued future customers are not entitled to the benefit of a refund because they aren't the ones who paid the higher-than-necessary rates. They also argued the longer payout period will mean that many customers who were charged higher rates prior to the change in tax law will never see their full refund. CUB argued in favor of a 7-year payout schedule, while Raul's office argued for 5 years. We completely agree. It's only right that ComEd and Ameren customers get their money back over a more reasonable time, Chilson said in an email statement. Making customers wait decades to get their money means that a significant number of those customers won't be able to enjoy their full refund. That's not right. That's not fair. He also noted that many other states, including Missouri, where Ameren also operates, have adopted 10-year payout schedules. The ICC has not said whether it will grant the request for reconsideration. Next, we have report 123 children died while working with DCFS. Inspector General proposes changes by Sophia Tarine. A report highlighting persistent problems within Illinois' Child Welfare Agency showed 123 children died in the past fiscal year despite having contact with the Department of Children and Family Services. It was the highest number since the fiscal year ending in 2005, when the number was 139 deaths, according to annual reports released each January by the department's inspector general. The lowest it was during that time was 84 in the fiscal year ending in 2010. Of the 123 deaths, 24 were ruled homicides, 37 were accidental, 34 were natural, 7 were suicide, and 21 were undetermined. The Inspector General reviewed cases where children died despite having come in contact with DCFS in the 12 preceding months. The report cited ongoing and well-publicized issues, including children killed after the agency left them with abusive parents, a lack of foster homes for children whose first language isn't English, and children kept beyond medical necessity in psychiatric hospitals. We, Illinois, must do better, said Merrill Paniak, acting inspector general, in the report. We need to do more to support families early on before they get into deep trouble. But when families are broken, we need to act decisively to protect children. The dense 384-page report made specific recommendations on individual cases and for the agency overall, which should begin to analyze families in totality and in context, not focusing narrowly on the facts in the most recent hotline report, according to the report. A DCFS spokesman didn't immediately return a request for comment on Monday. Paniak noted the case of a 5-year-old suburban Chicago boy, Andrew A.J. Frund, who died despite having a long history of contact with the agency. He was found last year, beaten to death in a shallow grave not far from the family's Crystal Lake home. His parents have been charged with murder. A federal lawsuit has been filed and 2 state employees have been fired amid an ongoing internal investigation. Paniak said investigators ignored the parents' long history of addiction, and the case highlights opportunities DCFS missed to strengthen viable families. The inspector general concluded there wasn't a single answer to address the agency's issues, but proposed a set of fixes, including more training, strong supervision of frontline workers, and manageable caseloads. Agency officials agreed with several case recommendations in the report and have said that DCFS has been decimated by years of budget cuts under previous administrations. Recently, they've pointed to an expansion of simulation training and the hiring of hundreds of new employees under Governor J.B. Pritzker, who took office 1 year ago. Next, we'll turn to some sports. This article is entitled Seeking Toughness. Missouri State, ISU Looking to Bounce Back from Losses by Jim Benson. A slew of talented newcomers and a couple key returning seniors made Missouri State the preseason Missouri Valley Conference basketball favorite. Things haven't exactly gone as planned for head coach Dana Ford and the Bears since the season opening 67-66 loss at home to Little Rock. As Ford returns to Redbird Arena on Tuesday for a 7 p.m. MVC game against Illinois State, the Bears are 7-8 overall and 1-1 in the league. "I don't know if I'm surprised as much as I'm disappointed it hasn't happened faster," said Ford, a former ISU player and associate head coach. Within a couple of hours of each other Saturday, ISU head coach Dan Muller and Ford were each bemoaning their team's lack of toughness following league road losses at Southern Illinois and Loyola, respectively. Neither team has won a true road game, although, in fairness, three of Missouri State's five away defeats have come at tough venues in Xavier, LSU, and VCU. Muller knows ISU, 6-8 and 1-1, which has gone 6-1 at Redbird Arena, needs to continue playing well on its home court or risk falling behind early in the league chase, especially with the next two games on the road at Indiana State on Saturday and Drake on January 16th. "You've got to protect home court every year, but it seems this year is more critical," said Muller. "I don't want to let our road struggles negatively impact our home confidence. You have to be careful with that. We'll worry about that road stuff later." There weren't many bright spots for the Redbirds in a 67-55 loss at SIU. However, 6'4" sophomore guard Dedrick Boyd reemerged and could be working his way back into the rotation. Boyd, a transfer from Eastern Kentucky, averaged 12.6 points in ISU's first seven games. But he went into an offensive funk after that and scored 16 points in the next six games, three games being shut out, before making 4 of 10 field goal attempts and tallying 8 points in 20 minutes at SIU. "It all started in practice. Coach put me on the scout team to get my confidence back," said Boyd. "I put in extra work outside of practice. The slump, it was bad, but I'm getting my confidence back and ready to hoop again." Boyd's length on the perimeter could be valuable against Missouri State, which features 6'7" Josh Hall, 6'5" Keandra Cook, 6'5" Isaiah Mosley, and 6'5" Kabir Muhammad, doing much of their damage outside. "It was nice to see him do that against SIU, and he has to keep it up," said Muller. "If Dedrick gets himself playing well, I think it will help us offensively, in particular, but he has to guard." Boyd has learned quickly that playing defense will earn him more minutes. "I was looking to do the right things at SIU and pass the ball around. If it comes to me, it comes to me," he said. "On this team, I've learned how not to worry about my shots too much. I've grown out of that. I just want to win games and do my part." There was a lot of hype early for Missouri State to win a bunch of games and possibly get in line for an at-large NCAA tournament berth, should it not capture the MVC tournament. Returning starters Tulio Da Silva, a 6'8 forward, and Cook were picked to the All-MVC preseason first and second teams, respectively. Joining them were 6'8 Lamont West, a graduate transfer from West Virginia, and two transfers who sat out last season in 6'1 point guard Tyrick Dixon and Middle Tennessee State and Hall from Nevada. Ford also added one of the nation's top junior college players in 6'8", 250-pound Gage Prim from South Plains at Texas College. Prim has battled a leg injury that has limited him to 10 games, but he's averaging 13.2 points in 22.4 minutes per game. Our biggest challenge is figuring out ways to get him more than 22 minutes, said Ford. It's moved past the injury part now and trying to get him in shape outside of games when the injury probably will come back. Hopefully, as we keep going in the conference season, he gets his legs underneath him and he plays longer stretches. He's a kid who never practices and is just going out and playing. Mueller said Missouri State's size is a major concern. The Bears are plus 7.1 rebounding, while ISU is minus 2.2. They're so much bigger than us. They're taller and bigger, said Mueller. The boards are important. They throw it inside a lot, but that's just one guy, Prim. Rebounding will be a huge key on both ends. Next, the college report. ISU's Robinson makes Walter Camp team. Illinois State running back James Robinson has been named to the Walter Camp FCS All-America team on Monday. Robinson was among 25 FCS players selected for the team. He previously received All-America honors from the AFCA, Hero Sports, the Associated Press, and Stats FCS. Robinson led the Missouri Valley Football Conference in rushing yards, 1,917 yards per game, 127.8, and touchdowns, 18. The three-time All-MVFC selection for 2017-19 and two-time Walter Payton Award finalist recorded 8 100-plus yard rushing efforts, including a pair of 200-plus yard efforts in the FCS playoffs that included a school record 297-yard effort in the first round at Southeast Missouri State. Robinson ranks number 2 in the FCS in rushing yards and yards per game and is 6th in rushing touchdowns. He finished his career number 2 in Illinois State history in rushing yards, 4,462, rushing touchdowns, 44, all-purpose yards, 5,236, and total touchdowns scored, 46. He will play in the East-West Shrine Bowl on January 18th at Tropicana Field in St. Petersburg, Florida. Illinois State redshirt freshman Mary Crompton was named the Missouri Valley Conference Newcomer of the Week for women's basketball. Crompton averaged 13.7 points and shot 40.9%, 9 of 22, from behind the three-point line in the past three games, helping ISU get off to a 2-0 start in the conference. Compton led the Redbirds at Austin Peay, matching a career-high 16 points and making 4 three-pointers. She had 13 points in a conference opening win over Indiana State and scored 12 points in Sunday's victory over Evansville. She tied a career-high with 5 assists and was 4 of 4 from free-throw line. She ranks second in the Valley with a 40.7%, 33 of 81, three-point field goal percentage. For the third time this season, Eureka College's Olivia Falls of Bloomington is the St. Louis Intercollegiate Athletic Conference Player of the Week for women's basketball. The sophomore forward had 20 points and 10 rebounds while shooting 7 for 9 from the field and 6 for 7 from the free throw line in a 93-58 SLIAC victory over McMurray on Saturday. She also distributed 3 assists. Falls leads the SLIAC in field goal percentage at 57.8, is second in the league behind teammate Ashley Harst of Pontiac in rebounds and with 10.6 per game, and 5th in points per game at 15.4. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Pantograph for Tuesday, January 7th, 2020. Please stay tuned.